Good morning. It's a privilege to stand here and share from the Narkees pulpit. It's also kind of scary. We all come from so many different backgrounds. There's a good chance of offending someone saying something, but that's why I like it here. I see the beauty in it. We're definitely not homogenous, and it keeps us all honest, and it keeps the main point, that we're all here because we believe in Jesus. And that always was a comfort to me when I was studying here at Hebrew U and coming here every week, to just know that no matter where we're coming from, Jesus unites us. So hopefully I won't offend anyone here this morning. As Chuck mentioned, I've been in Manhattan the last year teaching at a little Christian university. And I've been teaching Introduction to the Old Testament, among some other courses. And I'm not sure how much my students learned the last year, but I learned several important lessons. And one is just that there is a whole group of Christians out there, maybe here, maybe me sometimes, that has just lost interest in the Old Testament. And it's kind of sad. And I'll share a little story how that just encapsulates it for me. I was asking my students one time what prophet lived in the 8th century. And, of course, I didn't expect them to know, you know, Isaiah, Amos, Micah, just like that. But I was trying to encourage them to think about it. And out from the back, I hear this, Jesus. I'm like, well, I hope that the student was joking. But I'm not sure they were, he or she, I don't know which. And I realized that our whole church is kind of geared, if Jesus isn't the answer, the direct answer to any question you would ask of the Old Testament, it's not worth it to ask a question. And so we make a shell of the Old Testament, of what it was meant to be. And this living and breathing word, we've kind of, can't say emasculated, we've not allowed it to help us understand God more and to mature us in the ways it could. And so my passion is to get us back reading these stories, because all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness so that we can be equipped to do every good work, to even know what the good work is to do. And God didn't make a mistake when he gave the Old Testament in the first place. He was talking, he was in relationship to his people way before Jesus ever showed up, and Jesus was part of that plan, and he's extended that to the rest of the world. And we, like Jesus, need to immerse ourselves in these stories to mature, to do every good work. People often ask me if I ever get bored studying the Bible academically. And I'm not quite sure what they mean, because for me, I can't open the Bible and read it without God speaking to me. I refuse to separate spiritual from academic. I think that academic is just giving you more tools to hear God deeper. And if I am dry spiritually, it's not because of academics. It is just because I have a hard heart, like all the other humans out there. So my answer is, am I bored? No way. It's like asking if you're bored getting on a roller coaster ride. You might be exhilarated. You might have adrenaline. You might be overstimulated at times, maybe even a little nauseous, but you will never be bored. So there's just an abundance there. It never ends, like the story of the magic ice cream maker. And for those of you who know that story, if not, it doesn't matter. But I would encourage us to all read the stories more. And we are going to read a story soon. And I won't, just advance warning, I won't do it justice in the short amount of time we have. But I'll just tell you what I got out of it as I've been reading. But first, I want to ask why we don't read these stories more. And looking at the Old Testament, I'm not just wondering about genealogies or, you know, about the rules about if we beat our slave and knock out his tooth, what our responsibility is. Those, I think, I could understand a little more hesitation, but I'm talking about the stories. Why don't we read the stories more? Because these stories were not made for scholars, and they weren't made for kindergartners. They were made for everyone who has ears to hear, which means they were made for you and for me. And I brought up a little thing. This is my recent acquisition. This can be a wonderful tool, because if you can't always read the stories, I get sick on the bus, you can listen to them. And it's amazing how the story will come alive again as you listen, as they were originally intended to be listened to very carefully. So that's my sidekick. Go out and get one of these, put the whole Bible on it, and start listening. But here's why we run away from stories. They take work, like everything else truly satisfying in life. But we want fast food. We want an IV. God, just get into my blood right now. I don't have time to eat your gourmet dinner and enjoy it. Just give me. And I think that that makes him sad. And there's things about eating that are good. The digestion process is better for us than the IV. Another reason we run away from stories is that the answers are hidden and often complicated. We want bottom lines quickly. In a sense, we're selfish. We usually have our own little problem. We run to the text, just fix my problem, and I don't want to know about the rest. But stories have to be chewed on. In fact, I've been chewing on one story, the Amalekites, which I may mention later on. It's 8 verses long. I've been chewing on this story about 2.5 years now, and I'm still coming up with new things and new ideas. And it's amazing. As I said, the magic ice cream maker. It's amazing how much is there. So anyway, so God thought it was a good idea to teach us by stories. And it keeps us engaged. It makes us enjoy discoveries. And it lets us see many sides of a situation all at once. Some ironies and ambiguities. And we can't get away with trying to find a fast answer, so we become less judgmental, maybe. My dealing with the text this morning will probably bring out a few things, and I'm not saying that that's the only way to read it or that this is the only thing to get from the story. Remember, this isn't a parable. There isn't one main point that you're supposed to focus on. For instance, in the New Testament, we have the unjust judge parable. That parable is not trying to say God is an unjust judge. It's trying to say we need to be persistent in asking. It's got a main point. We're not supposed to focus on the details. But in a story, it's different. They're built on those multifaceted gems, and you can and you should explore the details because they're there for a reason. Every word is chosen. And as we chew on these stories, we're not just doing it alone, but God's Spirit actually will help us digest whatever we need from that. So I'm going to base my story on one, but we're going to flip to some other ones, too, to refer to as we go along. I've chosen to talk about Gideon this morning, one of his stories. He's got quite a few of them, and they're all good. It starts off in Judges 6. I had a staff member at my boarding school. I grew up in Kenya and went to boarding school there. And every time it was his turn to lead chapel, he'd always talk about Gideon. And I think I can understand why. Because here's a hero that we can relate to, at least those of us who are chicken and have an overdeveloped sense defense mechanism of running away. That would be me. So I don't know about you. Maybe there's some courageous, naturally courageous people out there. But this is for the rest of us. Another reason Gideon is a great hero is because he expresses something that I think a lot of us deal with. Because We have a tendency to think that it was easier for everyone back in the Bible days to believe, because if they had seen all those big things, how could they not believe? I mean, if I saw those big things, I would believe. And I think that's wrong. Over the years, the more I study these stories, the more I realize, no way. I would be the same way they were. And I think Gideon would disagree too. He's in the Bible. And look what he has to say. Wait, I gotta open my English. Judges chapter 6. Okay, just going to give you a flash ahead. Chapter 6, verse 13. But Sir Gideon replied, "If the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." So I think there are times in our life today where we can say the same thing. Yeah, that was great. Back then, they got all the good stuff. What about now? Where are you now? Are you now? Are you here? Have you forgotten me? Or do you just not do those things anymore? And so it's a very big question that Gideon asks and we can identify with. So as we're reading this story, we can definitely identify with Gideon. And I would remind us, as we read other stories in the Old Testament, that our attitude shouldn't be one of, why are you so stupid? I mean, duh, God just parted the sea in front of you. Of course he's with you. That should not be our attitude, or else we're missing the whole point. Because the point is that we are so stupid. I've already caught myself complaining about not enough garlic and onion at our house in Costa. My own family's house. And I've been there 4 weeks. I mean, not even to mention the people in the desert complaining about no onion and garlic. And they had to stay out there 40 years. I mean, who am I to point a finger? I mean, what if you were up in the desert, had no showers? How would you feel? Never had new clothes. Never had a change in diet. I mean, those people were actually amazingly patient. And I think we like, oh, ha ha. Like, we would do better, and it's just wrong. Anyway, so when we see their speck, the stories, we see their speck, it's to help us find our own log. Don't make God send you Nathan the prophet. And plus, remember that when we're reading this Bible, we have the advantage of hindsight. Not only of hindsight, but of divine perspective. Things that we don't always get in the present. We can see clearly and know what will happen when the people then couldn't. Like in a horror movie, you might see the axe man off in the corner and someone walks in the room, you're like, silly, look left, just look left. But they don't know he's in the corner. And what if we were given that same perspective on our life? Would we right now be saying, silly, look left? I mean, there's a whole different perspective, and I think God reveals that to us, but it's not readily there as we're living in the present. So, let's read Judges 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years, I'm starting from the beginning, for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it, literally to destroy it, the same way the flood destroyed it. That same word there. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried to the Lord because of Midian, He sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I have drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you live. But you have not listened to me." The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Evi Izri, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hands of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" In other words, I'm hereby sending you. "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together." And the Hebrew says, "as if they were one man." Gideon replied, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And the Lord said, "I will wait until you return." Gideon went in, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah flour he made bread without yeast, putting the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. And the angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and place them on the rock and pour out the broth." And Gideon did so. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace, do not be afraid. You are not going to die." So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day it stands in Ophrah of the Avi Ezris. That same night, the Lord said to... Oh, wait. We're going to stop there. So, we have a nice meeting with God. The beginning, the first few verses, sets the scene. Even the parasha ties into that. Midianites, Amalekites, all these enemies are attacking. And we have the divine perspective that he's using these people as punishment to, kind of like a spanking, to bring them back to the right way. You also know of Midianites elsewhere. They sold Joseph into slavery. They don't have the best image in the Bible. They are traders. They have a lot of gold, and that's their priority. And you notice they're out to destroy the land. They don't really care if they leave anything for the enemy to live on or not. And Amalekites, if you look elsewhere in the Bible, are kind of in that same vein. Not morally very high standards. But anyway, regardless of their moral standards, God is using them as a spanking of his own people. Israel becomes weak. Dal, the opposite of rich. They become poor. And that's when they pray. And I think that's another thing we relate to. It's when it comes down to money, then we go to God. Okay, how am I going to do this? Or I don't have money. It becomes very real to us. And they were the same way. They run out of money, they run out of food, and then they go to God. If I were God, I'd be a little upset. But God is full of mercy. And as he's full of mercy with us. And he does send a prophet to remind them in verse 8 to 9. It's interesting, this prophet is anonymous. I don't know why. I guess our focus isn't supposed to be taken off completely into his own story. But he basically tells them, look, you're the ones that disobeyed. He's trying to point out why they've been struggling. And I'm not saying here, by the way, if you're poor, that you've been sinning and God's trying to punish you. But in this case, the presence of this prophet is telling us that. So don't start pointing fingers at other people, but just listen to what God's telling you. It could be that that's the case. So then we get our story. Gideon is threshing grain in a wine press. Okay, that's not where you thresh grain. Any students from Hebrew Ulpan know you thresh grain in a threshing floor. But he's in the wine press because he's afraid. And he's trying to hide his grain from the Midianites. Probably would have looked pretty funny if you saw him there. And God's messenger shows up, and he says, God's with you, great warrior. And I think there's a little bit of irony there, because he's in the middle of being very afraid. And he might be. This is the beauty of stories. He might actually be a warrior, because we find out later his family is in his little area is not a small family. He's got 10 slaves that help him do what God told him to do. And it could be he was already involved in raids against Midian. We don't know. But that picture, we see him in his weakness, and here he's saying, great warrior. God is with you. This, by the way, is not some great prophetic statement. This is a greeting. Hi. And if you want me to back that up, look at Ruth. Ruth 2:4. Boaz is coming back from a journey. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they called back. Like, Salam Aleichem. Or, Salam Aleikum. A little mix of languages there. Aleikum as-salam. It's a greeting. And Gideon takes this time to use that greeting and vent his frustration. And I detect a lot of sarcasm in his voice. Oh, yeah? Is God really with us? Why did all this find us? And where are all the wonders our parents told us about, saying, hasn't God brought us up out of Egypt? Look, God has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian. Is God really with me? I don't see him. I don't see any miracles. I don't feel his presence. Apparently, Gideon didn't get to read chapter 4 and 5 about God's last deliverance. We did get to read that chapter. But as I said, we can understand Gideon's perspective because some of us have that same perspective today. And even if he heard about it, even if you hear about miracles happening for other people, if you weren't there personally, it's different. And so often we can find ourselves saying these words. It's nice that God isn't threatened at all by his questions. And we'll get to that in a second. Let's look at Gideon's words closely. First thing, why did all this find us? That little phrase brings us back to Numbers 20:14. Let me refresh my memory. Back to the desert days. When Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom, he's summarizing them, summarizing their history, their historical relationship with God, and he says, this is what your brother Israel says. You know about all the hardships that have come upon us. That's that same phrase. All the hardships that have found us, come upon us. Our forefathers went down into Egypt, and we lived there many years. The Egyptians mistreated us and our fathers, but when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our cry, and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Angel there is messenger. Okay, so all these hardships, either that's summarizing what he's about to say, the whole journey into Egypt and back, or maybe it's all the hardships that led them to Egypt in the first place. or both. So we have this phrase associated with captivity in Egypt. And then again in Exodus 18:8, when Jethro is coming out to meet the gang, Moses and the people. And Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they'd met along the way, and how the Lord had saved them. So, it's interesting. We see the same phrase in Gideon's mouth. Why have all these hardships found us? And I see some irony here, because when Gideon is looking at the days in the desert, he's saying, back then you did miracles. And he's using this phrase, but now hardship is finding us. But that same phrase is what Moses and the people of Israel used to describe their situation back then. So there was always hardship, and God was always having to do something. But Gideon's perspective, he's using that about him, and he's just looking at the past like those were the good old days. Next, he says, God has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian. That's very subtle. If you look at that, that's exactly what our minds do to us. There is a subtle distortion, because we know from just reading the chapter in Judges, the first verse says God gave them over to the hand of Midian. That much is true. But Gideon has snuck in that word, he abandoned us, as in it's all over. And that's the distortion, because with God, it's never all over. And even when he looks like he abandons, it's just a spanking. So Gideon, in a sense, is right about the bad situation they're in, but he doesn't see why. And he's right about not feeling God's presence, even. But he needs to be aware of the connection between the corporate behavior and God's presence. And this prophecy just preceding this story snaps this out at us. Like they had been told, God has brought you out of Egypt. And they were the ones that made the covenant with him. They've disobeyed, and so that's what's going on. So with humility, I would suggest that this can hit us right in a soft spot sometimes when we don't see God in our lives. We can ask ourselves, are we really plugged in? Do we see the big picture of what's going on? Could God be trying to get our attention? Have we not been obedient to something he's told us to do? Have we stepped away? Have we given God a chance, or have we turned to other gods? So don't just blame it all on God. Well, I just don't see him anymore. He doesn't do miracles. Well, what are we doing on our part to anticipate those miracles? So now let's look at how God responds to this question. In verse 14, he turns. God turns to him and says, go in your strength, what you have, and save them. I hereby send you. In terms of drama, I mean, he turns and says, it seems like there is a little bit of a click there in Gideon realizing this is God. Because up till now, it could have just been a man. It's a messenger sent from God. We know that, but does Gideon? Here it just says, God turned and says. And the fact that he says, I hereby send you, kind of sounds a little more, it must be a prophet or something. We'll see, Gideon wasn't completely convinced, but... But he says, go in your strength, what you have, and save them. And again, you could read this several ways. Maybe as a subtle reprimand. Like, okay, if God isn't with you, you do it yourself. You think God isn't with you? You try saving them. But I think more close to the whole statement is that God is bypassing his excuses. We, a lot of times, give big reasons why we don't come to God. If God is God, why doesn't he do this? Why does he allow that? Why didn't he do that for me? And we hold those questions of ours as excuses, in a sense, to be lazy or not to obey him. And I'm not saying don't ask questions of God. I think God chose Gideon because he was very honest. But as you're asking your questions, actively anticipate his answer. Remember to doubt your doubts as much as you doubt your faith. But here, God leaves the big question, doesn't even remind him or say anything about it, and he just makes it personal. What are you willing to do about it? Leave the big issues of pain in the world to me. What are you willing to do about it? And this reminds me, back again, of Narcisse. If you ever give a critique here, or a suggestion, oh, this would be great to do, why don't we do this? You may hear the answer, great, why don't you do it? And that keeps a lot of us silent. And I think that is Gideon's, that's what's going on here. So then Gideon starts talking about his insecurities. I'm the poorest of the tribes. Maybe in terms of the leaders of the tribes, he's the poorest. We've seen he's got 10 slaves, or 10 helpers. And that ties into Israel. He's a symbol of the whole Israel that had become poorer and poorer. And so God comes back to him in verse 15, and he tells him, I will be with you. What does that remind us of? I guess no one wants feedback. Jesus. That too. It reminds us of Moses. Go back. This is important. Go back to Exodus 3, the burning bush. This is Moses calling. Okay. Okay, so Moses is herding his flock at the mountain of God. Verse 2. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to Moses from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here am I. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. By the way, in both cases, in our case and then, they didn't necessarily, well, I don't know about our case, I have to recheck, but in the Egyptian stories, they didn't necessarily cry to God. They just cried out as an expression of their pain. And it was a cry of pain that God heard, even before they came to him about it. So remember that as you're thinking about God's huge grace. Okay, so God's heard their cry, as he always hears every cry of suffering. And verse 8, so I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I am sending you, sound familiar, to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. Okay, so there's that same phrase. We've seen already several parallels between Gideon and Moses. Who am I? You bring all your insecurities, I'm not this, I'm not that. God's first response is, I will be with you. And that should be good enough. And listen to what he says next. This is what has kind of stuck in my mind for a long time now. And this will be the sign to you. Sorry. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. What's the sign? It's a very, very strange sign. I mean, Moses is supposed to be getting, this is really God talking to me. And he gets a sign that it's only going to be a sign after he's already done what he's supposed to do. It's very, very strange. And I like that sign because I think a lot of us can relate to that. We get a sign that only becomes a sign when we're looking backwards. And so it's still after the sign it demands our faith, our faithfulness to take that step, to keep going, and then looking back, you see how the hand of God led you there. That it was really God who was talking to you. And if you think about Moses, everything he had to go through to get that sign, there was a lot. There was a lot of grumbling. He thought he was almost going to die. Maybe he did almost die. He could have gotten discouraged and given up, but he kept going. And he's our role model in that sense. So back to Gideon. Okay. Gideon wants a sign that God is talking to him. He wants to know that this is really God. Unlike Moses, who recognized God and immediately hid his face, Gideon's still not quite convinced. And so he goes off to get his little sacrifice. He wants to do a little ritual. And God waits for him to return, maybe also to repent. Who knows? So he comes back with the raw materials for this sign that are highly reminiscent of a sacrifice. Unleavened bread, meat, basket, all these references to sacrifice. And then the angel makes a fire, eat it all up. And fire, we know, comes from the presence of the Lord. It can be judgment, and it can be his presence. And as he is zapping the stuff on the stone, the messenger all of a sudden disappears. And so I find, once again, irony there, that the sign that God was with him was that he was taken away from him. He disappeared. And then he realized, oh, that must have been God. Another strange sign. And I would say, here Gideon's complaining that God had never done a sign for him. Now he's got his sign. God disappeared, or this messenger disappeared in front of his eyes. Something he can't explain. He got his sign, but as him, as us, our memories play with us. And even when we've experienced signs, our memory is capable of doubting. No matter what sign you've experienced, I had a friend who was healed from epilepsy, and he does not believe in God. So it really, that cannot be your excuse. Our memories are amazing things, and they need to be trained because they can warp what has happened, even our own experiences. And it takes an active faith and obedience to what you hear to keep that straight. So, in a sense, Gideon wanted a sign of God's presence before the obedience, before he took that step of faith. And God is patient, thankfully. He's patient with me, and he's patient with Gideon. But also notice that when that messenger disappears, now God doesn't send messengers. He's speaking to him more indirectly. Who knows, prompting maybe much like we feel sometimes. I have never had an angel show up and talk to me. It's always kind of been more internal promptings. So maybe there was some, I don't know, not punishment, but some consequence for that lack of faith after just seeing a sign. Then Gideon goes from asking for a sign that God's talking to him to asking for a sign he'll really get the victory. Look at in 6:31. Okay. Did I get that right? No, I didn't get that right. Hold on. 36? Thank you. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor." Notice, by the way, his confidence went up a bit because he's back out on the threshing floor. But just a little bit because he's still putting his fleece out there, not his grain. Okay, if there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. And that's what happened. But that's not enough. He does it again like any good scientist. Let's do the reverse. Now I want verse 39. And he knows he's kind of, he knows he's pushing it. Because he says, do not be angry with me. You know, if I found favor, you know, let me just make one more request. This time, make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew. That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry and the ground was covered with dew. So he gets two more signs. God is incredibly patient. And this is supposed to be to tell him that he's going to get the victory. And I think we don't have time to go through all the stories and do justice to them all, but I think that there's always this tension between Gideon going from insecurity to oversecurity. Now he wants to know that my hand's going to get the victory. And it's a very easy thing to do. I think we do it all the time. And maybe I'll touch on that in a second again. He's still maybe a little bit selfish. He's thinking about him. And so immediately after that, in the story, chapter 7, we get God. Look at 7:2. So he's got all his men camped there. He's rounded up everyone from Israel. So we know he's taken a little bit of initiative. And as I said, he's back in the threshing floor. But now God has to say, you have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. And so he has to whittle away Gideon's army. And if you look further on in the Gideon stories, he's called a man of Israel. We've already seen how he epitomizes Israel. So in a sense, God is critiquing Gideon here. Lest you think it's going to be your victory, I'm going to have to do things so you know it's just me. So he goes from insecure to maybe a touch over-secure. Or over-selfish. Worrying more about his part in it. And that's true evil. It always comes in pairs. And that's why we're supposed to be on the straight and narrow. Because we can go off to one way or we can go off to the other way. And either way, whether you're insecure or you're prideful, either way you're doubting God's presence in your life. One, you're saying, I'm not really sure you're with me, God. I'm not sure I'm going to succeed. And so you're denying God's presence. And the other way, you're saying, oh, I think I am succeeding, and maybe I could have done it anyway. Maybe I'm just naturally talented. Did God really play a part in this? Whatever it is you're doing. Would it have mattered if I'd prayed? Maybe it's just me. And so both ways, you're denying God's presence, and you're focusing on yourself as opposed to God. And you may be right. You may not be good enough, but that's besides the point. If you honestly believe God is with you, you don't have to be. Don't go be a bum, but don't use that as an excuse for inaction. So, when we're looking at these stories, why is it that God always seems to have to prove his presence to us again and again and again? The whole book of Exodus is just one big story trying to say, I'm with you. Why is that so hard for us to get? Another thing all those stories are saying are, will you obey me? And if you read on in Gideon's account, the next thing he has to do is obey God, all these little things in terms of separating the men and how to go into battle. He has to depend more and more on God and less on himself. It's all very simple. Will we acknowledge God's presence and will we obey him? And again, another judge we won't get to today, but it ties into our parasha, Yiftach. He was also a judge, and he was he had a rough childhood, but he grew up to be a military leader, and he was going to go secure Israel's victory. And it says in chapter 11:29 that the Spirit of God came on him. This is still in Judges 11:29, and he went across. He went on his way to go fight against the enemy. Let me flip there really quick, because this is important too. 11:29. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Yiftach. He crossed Gilad and Menashe, passed through Mitzpah of Gilad, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. Okay, so the Spirit of God has already come on him. He's got his presence. He's been chosen. He's on his way. And what does he do? That's not good enough. He wants to secure. He wants an extra selfish security. Is it really going to happen? And maybe he was insecure, because if you read the beginning of the chapter, he was pushed out of his house. He had all kinds of problems. It might sound funny if I say that, but go back and read the story and you'll see. But the movement towards this victory had already happened. It had already begun with God's Spirit on him. He didn't need to make that vow. That was too much. And he becomes a prisoner of his own words. He can't take them back, and so he suffers the consequences. And unfortunately, so do other people. If he could have relaxed and trusted God as he's moving in faith, the victory would have been the same. The Spirit of God was already with him. So that can also be a lesson for us with this whole question of signs and how to move ahead in our life, no matter where you are. When we look at these stories about God's presence, what I want you to take away is to, first of all, to expect God's presence, because it's always there. It's just us that needs to be plugged into it. And part of doing that is taking the focus off of us and putting it back on God in the big picture. As you're doing that, avoid the extremes that we see in these stories of insecurity on the one hand and pride on the other, because both of them will take you out of where you're supposed to be. God will show up at some point in your life, as Christine always reminds us, with signs. And he's always working with you and in you. And he will be sure to make you realize it is him and not you. Faith and courage are both muscles, and they only grow when you use them. And so, as we go, God is with us. And thankfully that God's grace keeps working with us as we're doing that. So my final word to you is keep reading the stories.
Thank you, Sharon, for that very honest, frank look at human nature and some of the heroes of faith that we've all come to admire and emulate. But seeing them in flesh and blood helps us to see that we're very much like them, and they like us, and that we can learn these powerful lessons of faith by looking at the stories more carefully. And I like what you said. We need to as much doubt our doubts. Sometimes we put too much faith in our doubts. So thank you, Sharon, for your insightful look at the Word of God this morning. And I think that should encourage us to go out and trust the Lord that He is with us, and He'll be with us, and we can expect Him to show up and to answer our prayers and be with us in the life's journeys that we all have and all share together.